Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
Hannah, we're back from a week hiatus. We took a week off because you went up to New York City to see Springsteen.
Indeed I did.
How was Springsteen?
Springsteen's good, but you really need to be a really big Springsteen fan to spring for, you know, like $800 tickets.
$800?
And that's like kind of the average for good some. Lord.
That's like Hamilton stuff, isn't it?
It's way more than Hamilton.
Is it really?
Yeah. It is a high-end ticket to get. But for Springsteen fans, you know, it's an experience to be able to see him in a intimate setting, like a Broadway theater instead of some huge stadium.
That's awesome.
So it was different.
Well, on this episode, we are going to cover the new releases this week, but we're also in the middle going to loop back and just cover the one or two that we would have talked about last week but didn't. So let's start off with this week's biggest film by far, Halloween, which is actually, this is hard to explain. This is the 11th Halloween film. However, discount all the sequels and remakes and reboots. This is technically a sequel to the original 1978 John Carpenter's Halloween, but it's not called Halloween 2, it's just called Halloween.
So I'm one for 11 then with these Halloween movies.
Is this your first Halloween
this
movie?
This is my first Halloween
This is
movie.
Probably my sixth or seventh. And, you know, I remember the first one. I saw it probably too young. And I saw the 1998, like, Josh Hartnett version where Jamie Lee Curtis played his mom, and there was a Busta Rhymes version later on. The sequels can range from inexplicable to just god-awful. Hmm. But the original 1978 version is a cult classic. Horror buffs love the original Halloween. And we're talking a young Jamie Lee Curtis. And for those of you who aren't really familiar, you know Freddy Krueger is Nightmare on Elm Street. And Jason is Friday the 13th. Michael Myers is Halloween. Michael Myers, it's not a hockey mask he wears. It's just this white mask, and he's this soulless killer. We never really know why. When he's 6 years old, Michael Myers walks into his sister's bedroom and slashes her to death. We don't know. The sequels, some of them do offer up some ideas about some mythology and cult business, but remember, those don't exist in this timeline. In this timeline, it's 40 years to the day after the Haddonfield, Illinois Michael Myers murders, where he only killed like 5 people.
Only? Yeah.
with a knife. Now, Jamie Lee Curtis is back as Laurie Strode. She lives alone in the middle of the woods. She's estranged from her daughter, Judy Greer, who was taken away from her as a child. Jamie Lee Curtis, Laurie, was declared an unfit mother. She has a granddaughter now who appears to be about a senior in high school. Mm-hmm. And Michael Myers escapes on Halloween because he kills on Halloween. It's a sequel, but man, it feels like a remake. He goes back to the same houses that he killed the people earlier. He kills the teenage couple about to have sex. He kills the babysitters. He kills some cops. It's very,
very
similar,
reminiscent,
Hannah,
of the first one. Well, and since I didn't really see, I mean, I do know that the 78 version is a cult classic, and I think I've seen images of Jamie Lee Curtis's character and screaming from back in the day. And so I think maybe it's a good thing that I hadn't seen the other one. I mean, horror is not my genre of choice. It's just not. And millions of people love it. And there were plenty of people in that screening who seemed to be right on board with it. And I think they had obviously seen the first one, and there were visual cues and audible cues to things that had happened in the past. And so you heard a lot of like chatter during the film from the people around you when they were spotting something or chuckling at something. And so as horror movies go, it seems very standard, but decent enough for someone like me who just doesn't like a horror movie.
Now, personally, I do not understand the fascination with Halloween and Michael Myers. I don't get it. I appreciate a good horror film, but you either are a Halloween freak or you're not. And I, since I wasn't there in theaters in 1978, maybe it just didn't connect with me because I saw it on, you know, basic cable like Encore or something when I was a teenager. Therefore, I, you know, I'm not in love with this movie. I'm not in love with this as a reboot or a remake or whatever the heck it is. It's a decent, I guess it's a decent enough slasher flick.
Yeah, it is a slasher film.
But it's not necessarily scary. I mean, it's a guy who doesn't, the villain doesn't talk. He just kind of ambles around sticking knives in people. Sometimes, the director, by the way, David Gordon Green, I know him from Pineapple Express and Prince of Avalanche. You know him from Stronger.
Mm-hmm.
And our brand is Crisis. I remember you saw those and I didn't.
Right.
I believe he has never met a jump scare he doesn't love. Because there's a lot of, every time the thing transitions, there's a loud noise that's supposed to make you jump a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the problem. It's got this sort of intensity and tension that's going on throughout, but it's kind of, it's induced by the music and by the sound.
And it's very famous music. And they brought the soundtrack back.
It is. And so you kind of know from the very opening sequence, just with the graphics when they're, the opening credits are coming up, that music is already playing.
Yeah.
And so you're just kind of, you're seeped into the vibe of a horror flick from the get-go. And they try to have those moments of levity as much as you can have fun with a slasher flick, where I love, there was like one scene where some kid is going, you know, so what, he killed five people. By today's standards, that's nothing. You know,
that's
when
right,
they're talking
actually,
about this 40-year-old crime. And this kid today who's so used to seeing all these mass murders.
Yeah, when 40 kids get mowed down at a high school,
exactly.
What's five kids on Halloween night?
Yeah, you know? So that kind of stuff was kind of funny. It's still shocking how many people die and how they just keep killing people in the most macabre sort of ways. And whenever you see a knife, it's not going to end well. So even if it's a kitchen knife, a butter knife, I don't care, any knife. You know that the Michael Myers character is somewhere looming. And just to put it into perspective, too, I mean, the idea is he's been locked away for 40 years. And so he just happens to, you know, escape. It's that whole, being transferred. That never goes well when
you have to transfer him on Halloween night.
That's right. When a homicidal maniac is being transferred after all these years on Halloween night, you know it's not going to end well.
Well, you either know already if you're a Halloween fan. Or you're not.
Yeah.
You know, nothing we say will persuade you or dissuade you from seeing this.
And if you are a fan, knock yourself out.
Well, looping back to last week, I do want to persuade the audience to go check out First Man, where Ryan Gosling plays Neil Armstrong, directed by Damien Chazelle. Damien Chazelle is still a very young director, and he already has a Best Director Oscar,
La
La Land.
It was 2 years ago, the whole Moonlight La La Land.
2 years ago,
debacle.
He directed La La Land, and before that, he directed Whiplash. This guy is gold.
Mm-hmm.
And he directs, he adapts a novel, a nonfiction book of the life of Neil Armstrong. Yes, it's about Apollo 11. Yes, it's about him landing on the moon, but not really. It's actually about Neil Armstrong, the man, the human being, what makes him tick, what's his motivations, why is he sad all the time. It's about him as a human being. The space program's there, but it's in the background. And it's about the tragedies in his life, the relationship with his wife, the relationship with his kids. So Damien Chazelle's First Man grabbed me. I loved it. It's not in my top five pictures of the year, but it's in my top five directors of the year and score.
I'm with you with direction and with score. And I love Ryan Gosling. But this movie was a disappointment to me. I was so looking forward to it from the very first trailer that was released. And I love Damien Chazelle. I loved La La Land. I loved Whiplash. I love space movies. I loved Apollo 13. And so this one has all these ingredients, and I should have loved it. And I'm not in the minority, or I'm not alone here. There are a lot of other people I've talked to who feel the same way, that they were disappointed in this film. And maybe it is because that whole stoic portrayal of Neil Armstrong and what made him tick, and the fact that what makes him tick is very flat. And so Ryan Gosling plays Neil Armstrong perfectly, but it's just not a very dramatic role and not a very dramatic, engaging kind of person. And so I just wasn't feeling it up until that moon landing. You know, I love the part where you kind of are reminded of what it took to get man to the moon and how it was such a communal experience. And I have a very, very, very vague recollection, or at least I'd been told over the years, that I was plopped in front of a TV in 1969 for, was it 69? In 1969 for watching the moon landing, because everyone was watching. And so there are parts of this film that grab me or that are motivational, but in the ranking of movies that have grabbed me, Hidden Figures, even Gravity, which I didn't love, I thought just had a more spectacular kind of appeal. There was a movie, October Sky, that I loved, The Right Stuff. This just didn't reach those heights for me.
I wonder if you were grabbed by the moon sequence because of what he did with the camera. The rest of the movie is like 16 millimeter and very grainy film footage, which all movies used to be shot in, and it's very familiar from back in the day. And then, as soon as he steps foot on the moon, it's 65 millimeter IMAX lenses. A crystal clear.
And we didn't see it in IMAX.
But you can still tell in the regular theater we saw it, like, this is really clear, amazing footage.
Yeah, but I even appreciated the things that were shot very tight, where it's like claustrophobic when you realize what a death trap these guys who were part of the space missions, what they put themselves through.
You can hear the nuts and bolts.
Yeah, the nuts and the bolts and the vibrations and the
took a lot of bravery.
And the equipment that sometimes goes wrong. And what got Neil Armstrong into that position to be the first man on the moon was the death of others that preceded him, that, you know, in the, as they called it, the Gemini mission, and people would be like, Gemini? But apparently that is the way it was pronounced.
Well, listen to you. You're backing this film now. You're defending this film right now, and you said you didn't even like it.
No, I'm defending the fact that I should have liked it, that it had all these elements that I would normally really like, but I was still in total just kind of underwhelmed by the very things that you loved about it. So that fact that you love that storytelling of what made Neil Armstrong tick, to me, that was the slowest, draggiest part of this film. And I just, that part of it just didn't really work all that well for me. I was more into the same elements that I'm into when I'm watching these other space movies. And that is the risk, understanding the psychology of all of the folks in NASA and the mission that they were on, and the mandate that they were under by
Kennedy. And this is not a movie about
Kennedy.
That at all.
It's not. It's not. And so if you are going into it expecting that, you might, like me, be somewhat disappointed. If you are going into it for the very things that you liked about it in terms of the psychological profile of a very stoic Neil Armstrong surviving some personal tragedy to pursue his life and career in doing spaceflight and testing, then you're going to be in your camp and you're going to like this film more.
Well, First Man is also an example of a film where critics like it more than the audience does. It's got a very high...
But I'm the audience.
Metacritic and Rotten Tomato score, huge.
Yeah, exactly.
But a lot of people chose to go see the second weekend of Venom and A Star Is Born instead. It got hurt pretty bad at the box office. And it premiered at Toronto, and when it did, it garnered this fake, ridiculous outrage where Damien Chazelle did not actually show Neil Armstrong stick the flag into the moon. You can see the flag on the moon in certain shots. It is there. You can even see him kind of preparing the hole. But he doesn't show this, like, Christopher Columbus, I claim this land moment. And conservative websites got really mad at that. And how dare you? And we're going to boycott First Man.
Yeah.
And it's ridiculous. What a fake outrage.
That was a absolute non-controversy. I actually had more of a problem with there is dramatic license taken in other aspects and with a critical scene near the end involving the memory of the daughter that he lost. I had to look up whether or not a certain incident really had happened or whether that was dramatic license. And it turns out, I think, that it was dramatic license. And so to me, that sort of deflated what was this this most emotional of scenes. So again, I consider myself always sort of on that border of, well, there's the critical review and the audience review, and I try to kind of combine them, and I think that's that I'm kind of right in the right in that wheelhouse for why the audience score is not as high as the critical score.
All right, our next film is garnering certain awards attention, limited, but it's also opening this week in a certain amount of theaters, called Beautiful Boy. I did not see it. You did. All I know is that it stars Steve Carell and Timothy Chalamet, who we haven't really seen since his awards season last year with Call Me By Your Name. And naturally, I looked up the director, Felix van Groningen, and we know him because his movie, The Broken Circle Breakdown, won the DC Film Critics Best Foreign Film Award like 4 or 5 years
Several years ago.
Shocking to me, but because, you know, it's okay. But how is his second follow-up, Beautiful Boy?
It's okay. Timothy Chalamet is amazing, and I would not be surprised to see him. I'm hearing buzz that he could potentially fall into that supporting actor category, even though he and Steve Carell are very much on par, that one or the other might get, you know, theoretically a best actor consideration, and the other would get supporting. He shows that Call Me By Your Name was not a fluke, that Timothy Chalamet is an incredible actor, that he's just going to be one that we're watching for a long time to come. And he plays this 18-year-old addict. Basically, Beautiful Boy is based on two memoirs written by both the father and the son. And so what you're seeing is the perspective of what's happening between this father and son when the son is spiraling into this world of addiction. He is a really good kid, good student, you know, like on the water polo team. And he dabbles in weed, and suddenly then he experiments with meth, and then becomes like this crystal meth addict, and his world just spirals out of control. And you end up on this 2-hour-long emotional roller coaster of a cycle, watching a cycle of recovery efforts, relapse, recovery, relapse, recovery, relapse, for over the course of a couple of years, I think. And, you know, with this kid who's in this very loving family and whose father is just struggling to, you know, they all love him dearly and they're just struggling to help him out. So it's an addiction movie. It is it's not great in its totality, but the performances are all really good. Timothy Chalamet is really good. And so that's why you're hearing potential awards buzz. But it might actually run into awards. There's a potential race between this film and another one called Ben is Back with Lucas Hedges, which, and Julia Roberts, I believe, which is another addiction movie. And so they might sort of be either canceling each other out, or it might be just too much for one award season to have just multiple addiction films. Plus, on top of that, Lucas Hedges is in another one called Boy Erased. So you've got which is about conversion therapy and stuff like that. So you've got just Beautiful Boy, Boy Erased, and Ben is Back that are all coming out around the same time. All are sort of thought of as awards movies, and I think this one will kind of be one of the first to sort of fade away.
I really do not look forward with pleasure to movies about drug addiction, because I just find them plotting, and it takes a certain amount of effort to sit there and watch the familiar arc start up high, go way down low, maybe get up towards high towards the end, or just it ends low, because just not all those, many of those stories don't end well. Oh man, there's usually 5 to 8 of these a year, through, you know, interspersed, some blockbusters, some indies, and you're like, oh god, here comes another drug movie.
It is. It's one of those films that is trying so hard to be an Oscar movie that it almost hurts itself by just trying too hard. And knowing that it's based on these two memoirs, you kind of know that it certainly won't end in one particular way, because these two folks, David and Nick Sheff, actually wrote these books. And so knowing that the books exist and that this film is based on that, you know that he probably is surviving his addiction. but you are on this up and down total cycle of the same beat over and over again. And then you get that postscript that comes up at the end of the film, and you kind of wish you had seen some of that as part of the film itself, as opposed to just a quick little, you know, here we are a few years later and here's the status of these guys. I kind of wanted to see more of that so that the film didn't feel like such a downer, because in the end it does feel like a downer.
Well, one film I saw that you did not see is a foreign film called The Guilty. It's from Denmark, and it's Denmark's entry into this year's Best Foreign Film Oscar race. And it's now in my top five best foreign films of the year. In Danish, it's Dane Skildiga, I think.
And it's by, I'm sorry, could you repeat that, please?
No, I cannot. It's by a director named Gustav Müller, and it's about a cop, Asger Holm. Now, did you see a couple years ago Tom Hardy play Locke? And Locke was famous because it took place in a car. And that's all it was, is in a car.
I think we've got a screener for it, and I watched a little bit of it.
I really liked it. And it also reminded me of Ryan Reynolds in Buried, where the entire thing takes place in a coffin. Asger Holm, played by Jacob Settergren, probably Jakob Settergren in real life, the entire thing takes place in a room, one room, and in a 911 dispatcher room. But over there, it's 112. And he's in trouble. You can see this. He's on desk duty because he's a cop and he's a hothead and he got in trouble. Like, he's waiting to see his fate. And this is like his punishment. You're going to go do 911 duty for the night. So he answers an emergency call from a kidnapped woman. She's trying, you know, she's pretending like she called someone else, but she's talking to him, and he finally figures it out and she's in trouble. And when the call is suddenly disconnected, the search for the woman then and her kidnapper begins. And it takes place in one room, with just Anders on the phone and on a computer calling different people. And I was nailed. Oh, man, I was nailed in my seat. It is intense. There's twists, there's turns. You don't know what's coming next. He is awesome as Asger, as a guy trying to just hold his stuff together. I was really taken in by The Guilty, and I hope this does garner awards attention.
Well, I do have the link. I plan to see it because it is getting a lot of buzz. And Artie Chick, Jill, did review it for Chick Flicks, and so she loved it. And so knowing that she loved it as well, it's definitely one of her favorites of the year. So I think I definitely have to put it on my list for catching before before all those nominations come out. And hopefully, based on your high praise and Jill's, then maybe it will in fact make the short list for the foreign films, in which case, if it does, I will definitely be watching it.
Yeah, folks, if this somehow comes to your town, and I hope you live in a big city, you need to check out The Guilty. It is really good. Now, one that you saw that I did not see is called The Oath, and I was shocked when I saw the director, Ike Barinholtz. I know Ike Barinholtz from movies. He's an actor. He's a comedic actor, in fact. He was in this year's Blockers. He played one of the parents, one of the Blockers. I remember him from Sisters. He was in Suicide Squad. He's a funny guy, and what's he doing directing a movie now called The Oath?
And starring in it, I believe.
Oh, dear.
So I thought you had seen this one. So
no,
this
I didn't.
Is a shock
this
to
is
me.
This is all you.
This is totally one that you should have been seeing because it is dark satire.
Oh, I love dark satire.
Exactly. And with a very timely, frighteningly timely political message. And it is all about, and when it's Tiffany Haddish, and you know, we just saw Tiffany Haddish in Night School, and here she's playing a very different kind of role, and so I think she shows a little bit more range with this role than Night School. I felt like she was sort of phoning it in. She's kind of interesting in The Oath, where she's it's really a Thanksgiving family film, and what happens is just before the holidays, the administration, the White House, it puts out the word that they want all the U.S. citizens to sign an oath of loyalty to the president, who is not named. And and so here you've got this very progressive couple who is like going, what? That's crazy. You know, there's no way we'd sign something like that. And it's not mandatory. It's perfectly, you know, you're free to sign or not sign. But of course, if you don't sign, then gee, what, these government agents are going to be looking a little more closely at you. And so there's this pressure to sign by with like this post-Thanksgiving deadline. And sure enough, this family's getting together right around Thanksgiving, and it's a very divided family. And you start learning who is leaning towards signing, who has already signed, and you know, things sort of fall apart at the dinner table. There was supposed to be this edict of no politics at the dinner table for Thanksgiving.
That always holds up.
Yeah, but Ike Barinholtz's character Chris is like this TV news junkie, and he's obsessed with sort of being tuned into what's going on. And he's also just absolutely appalled. He'd be at every demonstration, and so he just can't. As much as he tries, he just cannot prevent himself from glancing at his phone and seeing the news. And then he discovers there's breaking news during Thanksgiving about how these demonstrators against the oath have been fired upon. And so there's all these people that have been killed. And so he's outraged, and he doesn't understand how everybody at the dinner table wouldn't be outraged. And it's just then what happens is all of a sudden somebody must have called somebody and let them know that that this guy Chris is not all that loyal. And suddenly these two government agents from some new shadow agency show up at the door at Thanksgiving, and it things go way off the rails. And that's when this turns into a really, 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 really dark, twisted satire.
Sounds good to me, dude.
I know. I think you'd probably like it. The problem is that, you know, it's in some ways it was being touted as this holiday comedy. It's just not. It's really just kind of like, oh my gosh, it's frightening how close to home it feels like it hits, and it's wicked dark satire. But the fact that it hits a bit too close to home could prevent people from seeing it, because kind of like Fahrenheit 11/9. It's you just don't want to see reality right now. You'd rather see, if you're escaping to the theater, you're looking to escape. This doesn't let you escape. It kind of digs you further into that hole of political tribalism and family divisiveness over politics. And, you know, going into, as we near the Halloween Thanksgiving stretch, some people might not be too keen on seeing this.
Yeah, I think it sounds awesome.
Yeah, I think you'd like it, so you should catch up with it.
Our next film, I believe I'm the only one who saw it, is a documentary called Gary Winogrand, All Things Photographable. And I've never heard of Gary Winogrand, and it seems like every year we do actually get two or three documentaries about photographers. And
that I've never heard of.
I've never heard of any of them, and some are really funny. Some are good, like Finding Vivian Meyer,
yes.
I remember was awesome.
That was good.
And some just fade away, and I forget I ever saw them. I just don't remember them, because you know, I like looking at pictures as much as the next guy, but man, I'm just not that much into photography. But this guy, Gary Winogrand, he's described as a hyper-masculine Bronx Jew. Now, a lot of people who may know what that means, they had to explain it to me. What that means is a Bronx Jew. Apparently, they're very brash and very loud, and like, oh, you can tell he's a Bronx Jew. Okay, whatever, fine. Now I know.
All right.
This is a documentary portrait of his life and work, and apparently he was this acclaimed photographer in the mainly in the 60s and 70s, but there's work from the late 50s and early 80s. He died in the mid 80s, and he was known as, quote, a street photographer. You know, he wasn't taking arty portraits of these beautiful, gorgeous people. No, he was in the messy Manhattan streets, you know, filming protests. Then he'd go off into the wire country and really enjoyed photographing Texas and Los Angeles, California. And what happened was, over time, he took so many pictures, more than he could ever develop, that he was charting America's change across these tumultuous decades. And you know, you didn't know it in the moment. You didn't know it while you were doing it. But posthumously, as they were developing all these negatives, these thousands upon thousands of negatives, they're like, wow, he watched America change through his street lens. And all right, so that was interesting enough, but not as interesting as me to beg or tell anyone to run out to the theaters to see this.
Yeah, I think Artie Chick had sort of the same take on it, because she is a photographer buff, and so she got way more out of it than I probably would. And really did seem to bottom line it as it's a good documentary for the photography buff, but not so much for anyone who isn't into photography. And so there you have it. You joke that how many people, you know, oh, this is a great movie if you are a photography buff and cinephile combined. And how many people is that? So many people that that this film will probably not last very long in theaters, if it is anywhere.
No, I'm going to forget about Gary Winogrand. It's not terrible, but man, yeah. I'm just going to forget about it.
Yeah.
Finally, I'm also probably going to forget about our next film and last film, documentary, Late Life, The Chin Ming Wong Story. Now, I went in this knowing who Chin Ming Wong was, which is the only reason I watched it. And I think I'm one of the few people on planet Earth who have, because I'm a baseball fan and I remember this guy. He's the first and only Taiwanese player for the New York Yankees. This guy was the American League wins leader. He won a World Series with the Yankees. He was one of Time Magazine's most 100 influential people on Earth. That's how popular this guy was. He was known as the Pride of Taiwan.
Oh, I remember that.
After every time he pitched in game, which was, you know, every fifth day, uh-huh. Newspapers in Taiwan would sell 300,000 more copies than they did the day before. He's a superstar until 2008 when he got hurt. So Late Life is actually a close follow, a chronology of his endless rehab to try to get back onto a Major League Baseball film. Now, Late Life, that's named after the late sinking action on his signature pick. He's a sinker baller pitcher, which means he throws fastballs, and right at the last second, those things just drop out of thin air, which is why he could strike everybody out. We follow him from the Yankees letting him go. He was here in D.C. for a little bit, a cup of coffee with the Nationals before they kicked him to the curb. The Braves picked him up. And then he spent a whole bunch of years in the minors. And a lot of it's not as fascinating as it sounds, though. There's some empty space going here. You watch him. He must have gone on one walk with the camera crew, like in this desert setting, because they keep going back to him staring off and like to the horizon, staring up, standing on this mountain, like frequently. It's like you went on one walk and you keep using the same footage, I can tell. And he's also got a family. He's got a wife and like kids, and he's never home. And that part actually kind of hits home with his wife. She's understanding, but his son is like, where's dad? And why is dad not
here? He's not there playing catch with the boy?
No, he's not.
That's sad.
He's not. Even in the off season, he's not. So this is either the story of a man unwilling to give up, or is it a story of a man unable to let go?
So give me the spoiler alert, because I'm wondering now if it would actually work as a drama sort of.
Spoilers. Does he get back?
Right.
Does he get back onto it? I didn't know.
I don't either.
I was paying attention into the year what this happens, and I'm not going to tell you what happens.
Oh, okay. But tell me this: would it work as sort of like the Rookie remade?
Man, they would have to tighten it up. Oh my God, they would have to tighten it up.
Like, is there a payoff? Because if there's not a payoff, then I'm not really.
I'm not telling you whether or not he makes it back.
How am I supposed to find out? I'm going to have to check like Wikipedia or something.
Well, we're just, you know, I can get you the link. You can check out the Chin Ming Wong story.
Chin Ming Wong.
Okay. So it's going to be if you're a baseball fan, and this is for hardcore baseball fans. It's not for casual fans who watch a game every now and then. You go to a couple games a year. You're a Baltimore Orioles fan through and through. This might be up your alley.
I love baseball movies.
So maybe you'd be in on this, and there's a social aspect to it. But, oh, man, this is loose. There's a lot of space in here.
You know, after we watched The Catcher earlier this year,
you liked that more than I did. Paul Rudd in Paul The Catcher Rudd. Was a spy.
The Catcher was a
which
spy.
Which is not about baseball.
But it had that little bit of baseball in it. But, so I'm interested in this guy's story, but now I just kind of want to know the ending. I want to skip to the last
page. When we're done, I will tell you
what
happens. But if you really are a hardcore baseball fan, you might not know what happened to this guy. So it could be worth – so in D.C., it's only playing on one screen, like out of the way one screen, but you can find it. It's there in major cities. For the rest of you, you're going to have to wait for like PBS or Netflix.
And what's it called?
It's called Late Life, The Chin Ming Wong Story.
Okay.
And there's some baseball people that you know that pop up in interviews. This is inside baseball stuff. It talks about why his shoulder is messed up, what he does to try to fix his shoulder, life on the road, which is not very pleasant when you're a minor leaguer, things like that. So okay. That's awesome when it's about that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Gotcha. Yeah. No, it sounds like it's sort of a mixed bag. And so you got to kind of take the good with the bad. So we'll see.
All right. So on this episode, we were all over the map. We have this week's major films like Halloween, A Little Bit of Beautiful Boy. We got last week's major film, First Man. And we got a whole bunch of little tiny documentaries. So next week, I think we'll be back to our standard format. This was a little bit more hodgepodge. But out of all of these films, I'm actually going to say First Man's not my favorite. It's The Guilty. I'm saying the best out of these seven films we talked about and out of the four or five that I saw personally, The Guilty is the best movie I talked about today.
And I'm going to say that none of them deserve to be seen if you haven't already seen A Star is Born instead, which is still out there.
Hannah.
So I honestly don't. I mean, First Man is, I mean, they're all just kind of four individual subsets of people. There's nothing that I felt was great for a whole lot of people. So, yeah, I mean, that's just it. It's
reading between the lines, on these films specifically, I think you liked Beautiful Boy the best.
No, that's just it. I can't really say that I didn't like Beautiful Boy more than First Man.
Oh,
I would
you
say
didn't even like First Man
because I love Ryan Gosling. No, I did like First Man. I was just it wasn't. I was expecting greatness, and it's good. And it's not as great as the story is. And so that was my disappointment with First Man. It's still I rank it above slightly above Beautiful Boy because. Beautiful Boy, it was just a downer. And so if you're not okay with going to see what is essentially a downer with some really good performances, you're not going to want to see it. If you're okay with, if you're just looking for a Halloween movie, obviously there's one choice.
Well, then go with your gut and say, go see the Danish movie.
And I will say that if you are an indie and you like foreign films, that from what I'm hearing, The Guilty would be a good choice. But if you are looking for what's out there in the theaters and you haven't seen something like A Star is Born yet, and you've got
like
all
A Star is Born.
Because you've got all these other films coming down the pike, I'm just saying you're going to want to catch up on that one because that's the sure bet right now for the one that's out there that's going to be Oscar-worthy. First Man just below it, Beautiful Boy just below that, and then the rest are not. Oh, and The Guilty for foreign film. But the rest are just not going to be the films that you are that you're going to need to see in the run-up to the award season.
This could be subtitled, "We Watch Them So You Don't Have To."
Exactly.
All right. Well, thank you very much for listening to this composite episode of The Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah. Is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.